This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow is producing, signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services, and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. In studio, Fred Columbus Dent, the financial advisor who's been doing his thing for a few decades. Our producer, Robin Dow, said she thought he was around 35. Well, Fred has been around about that many years. In fact, he was there in 1987, which is exactly 35 years ago when the whole world changed. And to show you how things changed, the stock market collapsed in 1987. And in a year later, George Bush, who was the vice president, was elected about the same margin that Joe Biden beat Donald Trump by, 7 million votes over Michael Dukakis. So right now, we're 6 weeks away from the midterm elections as we stand on September 27th, 2022. What impact will the bear market have on what occurs on November the 8th? Right now, the Dow is down more than 20% from its high, and the NASDAQ is off more than 30%. Fred Dent, your thoughts.
Well, one of the things you asked me to do, Jim, yesterday on the phone was be prepared to talk about midterm elections. And I went back and did some research. Statistician Mark Hulbert has done a lot of research in this area, and I'm afraid to say some bad news. You cannot look into a crystal ball and make any predictions about the stock market related to the November 8th elections. It is not a statistically significant correlation between any kind of outcome, whether one party gains more seats or the incumbents lose seats. It is not a predictor. That's the bad news, because I know you would love to talk about that and for me to come in here and talk about a political aspect of it.
You're saying that you can't determine it.
You simply can't determine it. But again, that's the bad news. The good news is that typically and historically, after November 8th, the market rallies. And it rallies for about 6 months, regardless of who wins. So why is that? Well, it's really because right now there's a lot of uncertainty with what the outcome's going to be. We won't know until it's over. But when the election is settled, then the uncertainty leaves and people get back into the market. The other factor that helps the rally out is a seasonal effect that occurs every year. The market typically does better from the period of Halloween to May 1st. And that's all it is. And that's why the markets typically rally after November 8th.
Well, the crash we referenced, or I referenced, it was October 19th, wasn't it? 1987?
That's right.
That's right. So it was right before Halloween. Now, if that had occurred a year later, I think it would have had an effect, because it was at that time a calamitous decline. What was the percent? And basically, now you got to look at percentages. You can't look at raw numbers. The percentages are what really count when we're looking at how stocks are performing or not. But it was more than 20% on one day, wasn't it?
It was. At one point in the day, it was 24%, and I think it ended up closing down for the day 20, 21%, maybe 22%.
In one day?
In one day.
And that, if it had happened a year later, would have been a week and a half before the election. So I would think that would make a difference. But right now, it appears we're just going to have a sluggish stock market. And Joe Biden is now in negative territory from when he took office, slightly, but still he's in negative territory. Usually Democrats do well as presidents with the stock market. To give you an example, Obama and Clinton did extremely well, two of the top three in the history of the country as far as how the market performed. But in between, George Bush in 8 years actually lost ground. The Dow Jones Industrial Average went down over that 8 year period. And these ebbs and flows, they may not be related to politics. They probably are to some extent, but it's just the nature of the beast. And my guess is that you're riding it out, Fred Dent.
I certainly am. As a matter of fact, we're putting cash to work. We often work with people who come to us that have plenty of money, but they also have a tremendous amount of cash on the sidelines, and they're afraid. They don't want to make a mistake. They feel like, what if I put money in the market and it goes down even further? What kind of comeuppance will I have around that? And they're afraid to act, but they know they need to do something related to inflation, because right now with inflation running about 8%, if you just sit in cash, it's a guaranteed loss.
877-217-5757 is your number. Jim and Walker. Hi, Jim. You're on with Fred Dent. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, gentlemen. I think one thing that we're forgetting about when we're talking about that the markets could be impacting the midterm elections is the fact that 50% of the population right now is really, really mad. And the people, the men that support that 50% of the population, they're really mad too. Plus, there's a whole other section of the group that's really, really mad about what happened on January 6th. And the idea that the midterm elections are normally a low turnout election where people who have a political axe to grind against the party in power are the only ones that really show up to vote, and so they win. Right now, that has been put on its head, and people need to be thinking about it and realize what's happening. I mean, you've unleashed a juggernaut.
All right. More people are in the market now. But Jim's right. There are other factors out there, and I think that's what Fred was referencing, is that it's not just the economy, but also the insurrection. There's the lack of abortion rights now. There's an issue on guns. Imagine also if a horrible tragedy occurred a day or two before the election involving a mass shooting in this country. That would impact the election to some extent. But more people are in the market. Does that mean, as Jim said, more people are mad?
Well, I've never seen any statistical correlation between anger and market performance.
But what about anger in elections?
Well, yeah, of course. But again, as I said earlier in the preamble, that the stock market and the elections are not correlated. The stock market performance will be driven by many other factors related to the financial aspects, but not necessarily of who's elected. Maybe in the long-term policies. But let me give you some good news. I made a checklist of the good things that are happening, because everything is doom and gloom right now. It doesn't feel good. People are moody. They're negative. They see their investments down. Let's talk about inflation. Used car prices have peaked. They're starting to come down. The M2 money supply is shrinking, meaning they're taking some liquidity out of the market. That's anti-inflationary. Lumber prices are back to where they were before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. If you're a saver, you can get a 3% yield on a U.S. Treasury or a 6-month CD. Travel is cheaper. The U.S. dollar is incredibly strong. That has its pluses and minuses. But if you're looking to travel overseas, this is the best time in 20 or 30 years to live like a king against almost every major currency around the world. So get your passports updated. And if you don't have a passport, get one.
All right. Well, there are some positive things. And the Democratic Party has done a terrible job not accenting some of those positive things, including a reduction in the deficit in 1 year from $2.8 trillion to $1 trillion. Imagine if Joe Biden had $1.8 trillion in hot checks to throw around. I think the economy and the markets would be doing better. But much of this, of course, is related to the war in Ukraine, and that's something that I don't know if any U.S. president could control. It's there, and it has an impact on the economy and, by extension, the market. If Vladimir Putin were to give up the ghost in the next few days, that would certainly have an effect on the election, I would think. But how much is Ukraine doing as far as the negative numbers that we see?
Well, according to the OECD, the cost of the Ukraine war is $2.8 trillion when you look at everything. That's the bad news, and it is having an effect. But let's look at the other side of the coin, and that is supply chain issues, despite the Ukraine war, are ameliorating. They're getting better. Ships are no longer jammed up at the ports trying to get in to dump off their goods. Container costs for shipping have gone way down from the level that they were at the pandemic level. So we remain positive. There's always a reason to not invest. There's always a reason to just sit on the sidelines and do nothing. We're looking out 6 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, or with the average investor's time horizon, 20 to 30 years to make our decisions.
How do you think the rest of the year is going to go?
Well, I think October is probably going to be nasty. October is a month that is usually the worst month, where we have these big dramatic market bottoms, like we were talking about October 19th of 1987, my first day. First day on Wall Street.
I had Black Monday.
I had one suit, one tie, $12 to my name, and I got a job on Wall Street through just persistence.
And the world changed dramatically that day, and people were terrified, weren't they?
They were. As a matter of fact, it was a lesson day for me on my very first day. I noticed that there were two basic camps of the way that people responded. There were many people who were panicking and selling out. Just like now, you're going to have people who just can't handle the decline and they'll sell out. Mm-hmm. But there was another group who had their heads down. They had a plan in place. They didn't like what was happening, mm-hmm. but they didn't freak out and sell out. And I decided at that time, and I realized I needed to be in the camp that made the sound decisions and were more responders rather than reactors.
And in those days, I think the Dow at its high in that point was under 2,000, I believe. And now, of course, even with the downturn, it's right at 30,000. So the numbers are bigger. Watch the percentages, and we'll check in with Fred Dent. Things go according to plan next month. But thanks for joining us, Fred Dent. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Jim, for
this. This is Jim Engster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and Jerry Lane Chevrolet. And we're joined now by Casey Parks. An amazing story from Casey, who is a reporter for the Washington Post. And she was raised in rural Louisiana, Delhi, Louisiana, and has written about her life. In the Deep South, a search for queer identity is the headline in the New York Times review of her book, Diary of a Misfit, piecing together the elusive history of a Louisiana musician who spent all his life in a community that misgendered him. It is a remarkable book. It's gotten rave plaudits from reviewers far and wide. And Casey, congratulations.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you grew up in Louisiana, and as we know, in America, not only in Louisiana, but in many parts of the country, most if not all, there was widespread discrimination against people who were not heterosexual for many, many moons, and it was not easy for you to announce that you were a little different than your parents and your grandparents, but when you did, you said it was not taken well by your mother, and I would imagine your mother was part of her history. But there was another person in your life, your grandmother, who came to your defense. Can you tell us about that part of this story?
Yeah, so I actually grew up in Monroe. My mom and grandma grew up in the rural town Delhi, which is about 45 minutes away from Monroe. But we were kind of like, I mean, Monroe's not huge, but we considered it kind of the city, I guess, at that point. And I had gone away to Jackson, Mississippi for college and figured out that I was gay while I was there. And my mom, as you mentioned, was very upset by this, as was my pastor, who actually went in front of our whole congregation and prayed that God would save her and take her, meaning like I would ask for forgiveness and then die immediately so I could go to heaven. And I went home that summer to try to prove I wasn't evil. And everything kind of came to a head at a 4th of July lunch where my mom was crying a bunch. And my grandma eventually pulled me aside, and her words were really stark. She said, "I grew up across the street from a woman who lived as a man." And this was 2002, so it's a very different political time, definitely different social time. I had not really heard of people like that, and I certainly didn't know any. I didn't even know any gay people. And she told me that there were some mysteries about this person's life. She told me his name was Roy and that he played country music on his porch every night. And he had meant a lot to her at one point in her life, and I, at the time, wanted to become a journalist. I was only 18, so I hadn't yet really learned how to be one. But she said, "I want you to go to Delhi, and I want you to find out about Roy." And that is pretty much what started my quest.
And you did find things, didn't you?
Not everything that I wanted to. It definitely took me in some turns. When she told me, I initially had a much more naive idea of what this would be like, I thought. So she told me that Roy had been kidnapped as a little girl and raised as a boy. And so I initially thought I would go to the library in town and look at the microfilm and pull up a newspaper article, and it would say, you know, stolen baby, here's all the details, here's where he came from, here's where he is now. And it turns out that article didn't really exist. So what I had to do instead was just start knocking on people's doors and asking if they knew Roy, which is a pretty terrifying way of reporting. Even now, I'm an established journalist, and that still is makes me paranoid. I get so scared if I have to go knock on a stranger's door. I start sweating a bunch, and it's not easy.
But you did it.
I did it, yeah. And people were generally pretty kind to me. One reason I wanted to do the story is I felt like the national media often portrays the South as something homogeneously evil. And I don't think people are like that. I mean, as you said, I grew up in Louisiana and I live in Portland, Oregon now. And you couldn't really pick two different states politically and culturally. But in my experience, people in both places mean well and are shaped by what they grew up with. And I wanted to do a story, I guess, that cut through that showed that people do still love people who are different, even if they might, you know, have different cultural or political or religious upbringings. And my grandmother told me that everyone in town loved Roy, which initially was hard for me to imagine. But I think that people in the town did. I think sometimes they did think he was different and they didn't draw as close to him as they might have to other people. But I think, you know, there are people who stood up for him. A lot of pastors kicked him out because he wouldn't wear a dress to church. But people would go and confront the pastors and say, you know, this isn't what Jesus wants. And they would take Christmas dinners to Roy. And it just, I think overall, I found in that town a more complicated view than we often get up the South.
The book is Diary of a Misfit, a Memoir and a Mystery from Casey Parks, who, as she corrected me, grew up in Monroe, but of course has immense ties through her family to Delhi, which is not so far away. 877-217-5757. Jonathan in New Iberia, you're on with Casey. Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Casey. How are you both doing this morning?
Fine.
Oh, thank
Excellent.
You. I'm doing well.
Oh, outstanding. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I've been down here almost 30 years, since 1995. I lived on Williams Avenue. But anyway, that's the original train.
Wow,
that's the original train.
All right. Well, what's your question, Kate?
Back to the original train of thought was, how do you compare how you're treated in Oregon, you know, choosing your sexuality versus being here?
All right. Thank you, Jonathan. Casey?
Well, it's pretty much a non-issue here. I mean, there is a very high rate of gay people in Portland, and so I can walk down the street holding a girl's hand or, you know, I can go out without makeup or wearing flannel, and it just, no one even really notices here, which I think is the main reason I wanted to live here. I wanted to be able to think about things other than my sexuality. I feel like in Louisiana, sometimes I'm just constantly on alert of, like, people are going to think I'm gay, or people will know I'm gay and they might discriminate against me. I mean, I just had people make comments to me all the time when I lived there. So there's just like an easiness here, but, you know, it's certainly not a utopia in Portland. You mentioned Williams Avenue, which in the 40s, 50s, 60s was the, you know, the black epicenter of Portland, and people there all got pushed out so that they could build a hospital there. And, you know, Portland is a very white city. And so I think people of color often experience that same otherness in Portland, whereas Louisiana is a third black, and you would have larger communities and maybe a place to have that same kind of ease. So, you know, no state is perfect,
to say the least. Now, you talked to a lady named Pam who met Roy 50 years ago, 1972, when she was in junior high. Pam delivered some fascinating nuggets about Roy, didn't she?
Well, Pam worked in her stepfather's grocery store, and Roy would come in, and Pam would see Roy and feel like, you know, I'm like this person, but I don't think Pam totally had words for it at the time. She just kind of felt drawn to Roy. she knew him as a kid, so she didn't know like his intimate thoughts or anything. But Roy at one point had about 12 dogs and 12 cats, and he would kind of travel around town with them. And he left one of the dogs in the grocery store once, and Pam described like taking the dog back to Roy's house and how scared she was to try to go meet Roy, because she wanted to kind of ask him, like, how do I live my life? And I think that's something that I was doing too when I first heard about Roy, because as I mentioned, I didn't know any gay people. I didn't know just how I was supposed to live. I didn't have any role models. I didn't know if I would ever be able to be happy or accepted. And I think when you are a young gay or transgender person, you are seeking that role model to just show you, like, you're going to be okay. You're going to find your place in this world.
877-217-5757. A few more minutes with Casey Parks, who's written a searing memoir, Diary of a Misfit. Back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us. Robin Dow producing. You're listening to Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. In our remaining time with Casey Parks, her book is Diary of a Misfit. The New York Times gave it a exceptional review in 2002. When Casey was in college, she kissed another girl for the first time. A few weeks later, in church back home in West Monroe on Easter Sunday, she came out as gay to her mother, with whom she had always been close, but now reacted with shock and dismay. Her grandmother barged into the bathroom where a tearful exchange was taking place and admonished her daughter, "Some people eat hot dogs, some people eat fish." The message was, "Get over it." 877-217-5757. James in Metairie. James, you're on with Casey. Good morning.
Well, good morning to you, Jim. Good morning to Casey. These radical, deranged Christian conservatives, I have 2 points, who seem to lose their minds when it comes to LGBT issues, yet are nearly completely silent when it comes to people committing adultery, which I believe is still in the Ten Commandments. And this pastor who wanted you to ask for forgiveness and be saved and then prayed that God would kill you, so apparently you wouldn't sin anymore. Just like the radical Islamic conservatives in the Middle East who kill and hang LGBT people so they won't sin anymore. It's shameful.
All right.
That pastor actually last year confessed to the congregation that he'd been having a decade-long affair with his daughter-in-law. So they're...
You're laughing at the irony of this, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, well, sometimes those who are most devout publicly are least devout privately. Mike in Kenilworth. Mike, you're on with Casey.
Yeah, thank you. Quite by coincidence this morning, Casey. Thanks a lot for the book. I finished reading the book, and I wanted to compliment you on the excellent effort and really very enjoyable. I read the review a couple of weeks back in the Washington Post, and what caught my eye, of course, was the fact that the story took place primarily in Delhi and in Monroe. So that was that's what really captured my interest. But I wanted to commend, Jim, to your readers, the East Baton Rouge Parish Library. The book is available online. The book is available hard copy, and they have Audible versions as well. So that's how I got to read your book, Casey. And thanks for doing it. And I look forward to more books in the future coming from you.
Well, thank you, Mike.
Thank you so
much. And the East Baton Rouge Parish Library does remarkable work. And unlike other communities, books have not been taken out of the library. And Casey, I would imagine that would be a concern. There are some whack jobs who probably think that this kind of literature has no place in a proper library.
I'm kind of surprised it hasn't gotten banned yet, but I did get a message yesterday from a high school librarian in Texas who is trying to get it to her library, and I guess it has to go through an additional review because it is about a gay person. So she sent me some questions to ask, you know, basically, how can we pass the decency exam? So she was asking me if there were any sex scenes, and there are no sex scenes, and I do want it to be a book that is more of a bridge than a wedge. So I did try to, you know, I think my journalism super skill is empathy and trying to understand where people come from and to show humanity. So hopefully it will do that. But thanks to the East Baton Rouge Parish Library, that's exciting. I actually recorded the audiobook myself, so if y'all do want to listen to it, you can hear 14 hours of me talking.
Casey Parks, Diary of a Misfit. She grew up in North Louisiana, but went off to Millsaps, fine school in Jackson, Mississippi, BA in English, then Columbia University, MA in journalism. You're well educated. What prompted the initial move out of state to another, perhaps even more conservative state?
Well, no one else in my family had ever gone to college, and I honestly didn't know how to go to college. My school, if it had a guidance counselor, she wasn't someone who was active in our lives who taught me how to go to college. And I really was stumped. You know, looking back, I wish someone from LSU had come up and talked to me, because I had good grades. Like, I could have gotten a really good scholarship with TOPS. I could have worked at the school newspaper, but LSU did not really do a lot of recruiting at my school at the time. And actually, I later did a story about LSU's recruitment efforts, and they confessed to me that for years they did not recruit in heavily Black parishes. I mean, if you look at LSU, its racial makeup does not match the state's whatsoever. And they've made a lot of efforts in recent years to change that. But when I was growing up, they just skipped the primarily Black parishes, and Monroe is a very Black city. And so anyway, I did not know what to do. And Millsaps sent me a letter in the mail offering me $25,000 a year. And my family was really poor, so I thought $25,000 a year sounds like a lot of money. I think that's actually more than my parents earned at that time. So I went, even though Millsaps didn't have a journalism program, and I knew I wanted to be a journalist. So I kind of just got carried on by the waves of someone else's decisions, I think. I mean, I'm happy with how I've ended up in life, but I do look back and sometimes and think, wow, I could have gone without loans, and I could have had journalism instruction earlier on.
You do say Louisiana taught me to listen for stories.
Oh, yeah. I think everyone that I grew up with is an amazing talker. I just actually listened last night to a tape I made of my mother about 15 years ago, and she's telling the story of how she wound up marrying my dad. And she is just so detailed, like every detail that you'd want in a story, such as what car he was driving, what outfit he had on. I remember at some point she was talking about sitting on a porch swing under a tin roof in the rain, and just she was just naturally good at the things it takes many writers years to figure out how to do. And I think all of my family members were like that. They loved to gossip. They loved to sit in the carport and just talk and talk and talk. And I learned from them just, you know, what a good story is, not from sitting down and diagramming sentences or writing outlines, but from just listening to, like, what moves me, what makes people laugh, what makes people cry.
Well, it's a remarkable book, and Casey Parks is just starting what I think will be an exceptional career. She's already done some great things, reported in Africa where she survived an armed robbery, but we look forward to your continuing work, and thanks for sharing your story today with us. Casey Parks, Diary of a Misfit. Thank you, Casey.
Thanks for having me.
Talk to you soon. And we're joined in studio now by two gentlemen who are intricately involved in the fabric of Baton Rouge, Chancellor Willie Smith of the Baton Rouge Community College, and he's brought along his athletic director, Brock Cantro, who has a long history in athletics in Louisiana, Baton Rouge and New Orleans. He was on the staff at Tulane University. Perry Clark, fine coach, was leading the Green Wave, and he is now leading the athletic department at BRCC. Who knows, someday BRCC may be in the Southeastern Conference.
That'd be great, wouldn't it?
Two schools from Baton Rouge in the SEC. I'd love it. But you do have a lot of potential for growth here. Four sports right now, correct?
Yes, sir. We've got four sports, men's and women's basketball, softball, and baseball. And you mentioned me being at Tulane, and the world works in weird ways, because the guy sitting next to me to my left played football for Tulane. So we crossed paths a while back. He has an intricate understanding of how athletics can actually help a program.
Chancellor Smith, when were you playing for the Greenies?
I was there from 89 to 93. I was actually recruited by Mac Brown. He left and went to North Carolina, I don't know if you recall.
I do.
I stayed. But great experience, great opportunity, and I'm embellishing myself right now. I don't look like an athlete right now.
Yeah, you played with for Greg Davis, right?
Yes, I played with Greg Davis in a year and a half under Buddy Tevens.
Yeah, so you were playing with some good coaches, and Tulane, they had a disappointing game Saturday, but I would love to see Tulane play LSU every year, and I'd love for Tulane to get back in the SEC. They have won three SEC titles, and put that in perspective, in the Southeastern Conference, Kentucky's won two, Mississippi State's won one, Vanderbilt's never won a title, Arkansas's never won a title, A&M's never won a title, Missouri's never won a title, South Carolina's never won a title. So Tulane has one more championship than half the conference, seven teams in the SEC. So bring back the Greenies.
That's hysterical.
But Brock Cantrow, there are a lot of kids at Baton Rouge Community College. I think the enrollment now exceeds Southern University, right?
It does. Chance, you want to speak on that?
Yeah, we I'm excited today to announce we have over 9,500 students.
9,500.
We'll never probably have that many students in the history of Baton Rouge Community College history. We're researching that to make sure, but we are very, very excited to have our largest enrollment ever under my leadership, but also post-pandemic. Showing that students now are coming back to community colleges.
Well, you're a basketball guy, and that's a big part, two of the four sports, right?
Yes, sir, it is. It's and it's a hidden gem back there. I don't know if many people have said, when I say hidden gem, it's kind of J-E-M and G-Y-M as well. It's a great facility. It's right there in Mid-City, and people just don't even know it's there. And you know, our first job is to let people know we do have athletics, and it's part of a bigger culture change in the shift in college athletics in general. I feel really comfortable being involved in a community college aspect. In today's world, NIL, we're paying players, there's so much going on, it's kind of crazy. These kids that come to BRCC are coming to try to make a career. I mean, athletics is their career. And this is kind of last chance you for them, and they have a chance to get there and better themselves academically and athletically and go on to be successful.
Well, Brock went to LSU, same time as Shaquille O'Neal. You've gotten to know him pretty well, haven't you?
Yeah, I've been fortunate to know Shaq and Coach Brown. I grew up with Coach Brown. I've been fortunate enough to grow up around the LSU program, and it's been a life-changing event for me. Coach Brown has been a mentor to me. He was integral in me taking this job. I talked to him extensively about it, and after I talked to Dale and I talked to Dr. Smith, it was a no-brainer.
Yeah, and I tease Brock about this all the time.
Okay, we got to roll. We're back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with Baton Rouge Community College Chancellor, Dr. Willie Smith. And he has announced the appointment of Brock Cantrow as the Director of Athletics for the Bears of Baton Rouge Community College. Four sports in the program: baseball, women's basketball, men's basketball, and softball. Competing in the National Junior College Athletic Association, 9,500 students now at BRCC, a good facility for athletics. And Brock Cantrow, as noted, was at LSU during the Dale Brown years, Shaquille O'Neal, and Chris Jackson, who's a good friend of his, now Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, and you coached for many years too, not only as an assistant with Perry Clark, but had some success as a head coach. I'm surprised that you didn't take that route to permanently, considering the money that some of these head coaches make, Brock.
Yeah, looking back on that, I think maybe I made a mistake, but I think I'm pretty happy where I am right now. I'm at a place where I can make a difference, and at this point in time in my life, that's kind of more important to me.
And these kids, I don't know, what is the racial breakdown at Baton Rouge Community College, Chancellor? Is it?
So about 48% of our students are Black, African-American students, about 38% Caucasian, the remainder are Hispanic, Native American, and Asians.
So it's one of the most diverse places in the country, not only in the community, but in the country. And many of these kids, of course, were very good high school athletes and probably are looking for some way to continue their lives as an athlete. And you're doing your best. But what is the National Junior College Athletic Association like? Is the competition stellar?
Yes, I believe it's stellar. We last year was fortunate to have the conference champ and have the coach of the year. So we was excited about that. But I do believe participation in sports is vital to support the young men and women dream that want to continue their athletic career, but also get a formal education to be able to take care of themselves and their family. And so when you talk about sports, it is a very competitive league. We often chat and tease each other as colleagues. We have several sports at my sister institution, the LCTC system, and we basically talk about each other and bet. Hey, behind the scenes, we bet on dinner and who's going to win this game. So we're competitive as well. But we're just excited to support the young men and women dreams on coming to our colleges.
Well, this is a basketball-centric operation with two of the four sports. And I'm sorry to say this, but I think basketball players today are in far better condition than football players. When you look at some of these offensive and defensive linemen, they're huge. They're too big, and now it's desired to be that way. They want to take up space, but it's not healthy, certainly not long-term. But, Brock, I think basketball players are the best athletes in the world.
You know, it's fun to watch. I mean, basketball, I guess I'm, you know, a little bit biased because I coach basketball, but I mean, I do, the action is nonstop. They have to be in shape. Now, I'll tell you, soccer players are in pretty good shape too. But I just, you know, the sport itself, it just lends itself to viewing and to playing. It's just it's a great way to get out there and be part of athletics.
And some of these people who are big, you know, 7 feet tall, Brittany Griner is mm-hmm. what, a 6'9" woman.
Mm-hmm.
They do amazing things that people a foot shorter, they don't have their dexterity and
right.
ability. And Brittany's facing a very difficult situation now, 9 years in prison. I'm surprised Kim Mulkey didn't come out and defend her, Brock. You want to bite on that one?
I'll pass that one to the chancellor. I would love to see her come home. I'll put it to you that way.
Well,
I think everybody
coach,
would.
Coach, yeah. Come on. Dale Brown told me that if this happened to Shaq, he would be in Russia right now.
Right.
And you know it. You know he would.
He would.
What in the world is going on?
You
That's
know,
obviously
it,
a ridiculous sentence.
It is strange. I mean, and I think everybody wants her to come home. And, you know, and how we get her home is just nobody knows right now. We're all kind of at a loss.
877-217-5757. Brock Cantrell, coach and now athletic director at BRCC, and the chancellor is Willie Smith. Dr. Smith is in the house as well. Tim and Thibodeau. Hi, Tim. You're on. Good morning.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks to the BRCC folks. I've advised at LSU and at Nichols, and I know what you guys are going through, and I would congratulate you particularly for the junior college system, which could really, really help out so many athletes who want to go further, but sometimes just get tossed away in the maelstrom, you know. And the big thing I want to ask about is that you are issuing the AA degree, of course, and make sure, please, that all of them go with that degree, because then, barring something happening, they always have the hours. I was not so fortunate at Nichols and some other places, and when they got out there, they were no better than a high school grad resume-wise. So please continue the good work.
Yeah,
thank
Tim,
you.
Yeah, Tim, thank you for that comment. You're absolutely right. While we're proud on making sure we put a good product on the court and on the fields, we have some outstanding young men and women in the class who are receiving their associate degree when they leave us in very high demand programs. So if they don't make it, they don't fulfill the aspiration on becoming a professional or college athlete, at least they will leave with the degree to be able to get a good paying job. And that's what we pride ourselves in at BRCC, to make sure our students are well around it. But at the end of the day, they leave with that credential to get a good paying job and contribute to society.
How's the university doing, the school doing as a whole?
We're doing well. This is the peak time of the year. As I mentioned, I'm excited and enthused about our enrollment growth this semester, and we're going to continue to grow. We're building more relationships in the community. We want to provide the access that we need to our community to deal with the challenges that we face here in Baton Rouge and across the state. And we're just proud of it. Many of our young men are going out and we're starting an average salary of $55,000. That's a great return on investment back to the state, but certainly to our students and their families.
Do you have any information, Chancellor, regarding the number of students who go on to like LSU or Southern or other universities and attain degrees?
Yeah, so about 19% of our students transfer to the university. 19%. We could do better, but for the most part, many of our students end up going to work, which is a good thing. When you look at it on the opposite side, where we got a demand for 6,000 nursing allied health professionals. And so these young men maybe not transfer to the 4-year, but they're all going to work, and that's what we pride ourselves in, to make sure they have an opportunity where they want to transfer or go to work. You know, certainly we're going to continue to work with LSU and certainly provide those students. But at the end of the day, students are opting out of college and university because they need to take care of themselves and their family. We just want to support them.
All right. Here, another listener, Brock, asks if you're going to pull Scott Woodward and reassign all the coaches, give them big buyouts, and hire big names to be head coaches.
I love my coaching staff I have right now, and I think what I really love about our staff is they care about our players. It's just a different ball game than Division I athletics. I think everybody that's involved at BRCC is actually, not that people at LSU don't care about their student athletes, but there's a bond, and we're actually looking out for these kids' best interests, and we love being around them.
This is an opportunity at some point for the greatest women's basketball coach in LSU history, Pokey Chapman, to come back and coach at BRCC.
Well, you know, our head coach, Paula Lee, was an assistant coach with Sue Gunner back in the day, so we've got an LSU connection there as well.
And, of course, Pokey was a player and a coach under the legendary Sue Gunner. But on the record, Pokey is the greatest coach, female coach, in the history of LSU basketball. And perhaps, you know, by the way, the Gunner-Brown court is back on the agenda for October. Some people just won't let go. If you're going to name the court partially after a female coach, it should be Pokey Chapman, not Sue Gunner.
She was pretty darn good.
And she was a great player, too.
Absolutely.
877-217-5757. We're joined late, but better late than never. And Joe Pompeo, Vanity Fair. Thank you, Brock and Chancellor, and good luck to you.
Thanks so much.
Joe Pompeo has written a book that is getting a lot of attention as well. It's about something that happened a century ago.
Hello?
And good morning to you, Joe. Do we have Joe Pompeo? Okay. Can you hear me, Joe? I'm not sure he can, Robin. So let's see if we can get him in our remaining moments, but if not, maybe we'll have a longer visit with him at a future time. But the book, for those who are interested, is one that is a fascinating story called Blood and Ink. And it's about the scandalous Jazz Age double murder that hooked America on true crime. And I think we've lost Joe, so we may have to save him for another day. But it is a fascinating story from a big publisher, HarperCollins, and we'll see if we can make contact with Joe in the next week or so. But today is the 27th day of September, 2022. It's the birthday of the greatest third baseman in baseball history, Michael Jack Schmidt. He's 73 years old today. He led the National League in home runs a record 8 times. He won 10 gold gloves, and he reigns as one of the great players in the history of the game. 548 career home runs. He averaged more home runs per at-bat than many players who've hit more home runs, including Albert Pujols. Happy birthday, Mike Schmidt. Until tomorrow, signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and Jerry Lane Chevrolet. And we'll come down the stretch with the lightning round in the last minute. And Robin Dow reminds me that we can have Joe back very soon. So if Joe will hold on, we will tape the interview because I don't want to not do him just for his book, and then we can play it sometime in the near future. But Michael Jack Schmidt, I met him once in the Superdome, March 31st, 1984. He was the biggest star in the world, 3-time MVP then, and young reporter, and walked up to him. People told me he would never talk to me. He took me to the locker room. We did a one-on-one, just Mike Schmidt and me. And he was an exceptional interview. He unloaded about how in Philadelphia, sometimes you experience the thrill of victory and the agony of reading about it the next day. And he, I think, was the best player of his generation. Thank you for listening. Back tomorrow, same time, same place. Stay safe and stay tuned.